Welcome to Webinar Wednesday. Today is Wednesday, May the 8th, 2019. And my name is Aaron Lurie. I'm the Director of Professional Learning here at NAESP. Today's topic for Webinar Wednesdays is 6 early warning signs that your school culture is turning toxic. Our speaker for today is Dr. Robin Jackson, who is the founder and CEO of MindSteps. Welcome, Dr. Jackson, to Webinar Wednesdays. How are you today?
I am fantastic. And what an enthusiastic welcome. Thank you.
Well, tell the NAESP universe a little bit about yourself and your company.
So my name is Robin Jackson, and I have a company called MindSteps, and we provide professional development to school administrators because a lot of school administrators are under a tremendous amount of pressure to improve their schools, but they feel like they have to, you know, fix everything that's wrong with their school first before they can improve their schools. What we do is show you how to improve your school with the tools and the resources and the people that you already have so that you can reach a bigger vision for your school and live out your mission and your core values for your students and help your students have tremendous gains. So that's a little bit about me. I'm a former high school English teacher, a former middle school administrator, and now I'm an author and a professional developer.
Great. Can you share with us one of your books just in case those people out there in our universe want to grab it?
So I'm probably most known for my book, Never Work Harder Than Your Students, and that's published by ASED. But the one that I think would be the most valuable for administrators is a book I wrote to follow up for that called Never Underestimate Your Teachers, and it shows you how to move teacher will and skill. We often learn how to move teacher skill. We don't have a lot of resources that show us how to move the will. And usually, you know, I always have a saying that people hire for skill, but they fire for will. So how do you move teacher will? And so the first half of the book is focused on really strategies for improving teacher skill. And then the second half is really all about how do you move that will piece, which is a lot harder.
Well, thank you. Everybody's coming to our webinar series that's muted. And if we have questions for Dr. Jackson, we're going to use our chat box today. And at this time, I'm going to hand the presentation over to you, Dr. Jackson. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here to talk to you about a really hot topic that I'm seeing right now with a lot of the principals that I'm coaching, which is really how do you deal with a toxic school culture? And even if you don't feel like you have a toxic school culture yet, you have to make sure that you're aware of the early warning signals so that you can nip it in the bud before that toxicity takes you off course for achieving your goals and your vision and your mission for your school. So I want to start by sharing with you a quote, and it's one of my favorite. It's by Peter Drucker, and that's this: culture eats strategy for breakfast. I don't care how good your culture is. I don't care how ironclad your SIP plan is. I don't care how great the training is or the wonderful the book is that you want to use for your book study or how clear the data points to the right direction for your school. If you don't deal with your school culture, then culture will eat your strategy for breakfast. And I don't think a lot of us realize that. We think that if our strategy fails, it's because we didn't push it hard enough or we didn't give it enough attention or we have a lot of naysayers that are holding our ideas hostage in our school. And all of those things are just symptoms of toxicity that's lurking in your culture. If you have tried to get an initiative going in the past and it's failed, the likely culprit is culture. And so we want to talk about culture and look for these warning signs of early toxicity. So the first part of this webinar, I'm going to talk about some of those early warning signs. But then the second part of this webinar, I'm going to talk about what you can do about it. It's a strategy that I teach the principals that I coach. It's also a strategy that we teach at our conference that we do called Builders Lab. And it's so powerful when I see people who use the strategy and apply it consistently throughout their school. Not only do they heal the toxicity that's happening in their culture, but everybody gets so laser focused on the goals, the vision, the core values, the mission of the school that it does more than transform the culture. It actually catapults the school forward. You know, if you feel like you've been stuck, if you feel like you have these ideas for your school and you just can't get them across because there's a pocket of people who are toxic or because, you know, everybody's kind of negative or that you have a lot of naysayers, then I want you to stick around because we're going to talk first about what those signs of toxicity are so that you can recognize them and begin to deal with them. And then second part is that this is the thing. And I've been looking for years for the thing, but I finally have found the thing that will overcome toxicity in your culture and really heal your culture, help you create a healthy school culture that's going to move your school forward. Okay, so the first sign of toxicity that happens in school cultures, number one, is that there's a lack of a clear sense of purpose, which means that rules are more important than the people or the mission. So this happens when you go into a school and everybody's there and they're kind of doing their own thing. Everybody's working on their own purpose. And so teachers go in their classrooms, they close the door, they teach. They don't deal with the kids in the hallway who are not their students. They don't help each other out. People kind of are isolated. Everybody seems to be working towards their own goal. And when that happens, next thing that happens is that people start, because they don't know why they're there, because they don't know what it is that they're building together as a school, what happens is people grab to the rules as their security. So they want you to suspend the student because the student handbook says, if a student commits a certain infraction, you must suspend that child, without understanding that there may be mitigating circumstances. People they only look at the rules. They don't look at the people. Or you'll see this when people are working to the rules. So people are coming to work. They're only doing what's required of them, but they're not going the extra mile because they don't really understand the bigger purpose that you're working towards as a school. So when you see people who are working at their own pace and for their own purpose, they're giving you just enough to keep from getting fired, but no more than that. They're working to the rule, but they're not going the extra mile. That's a sign and an early warning signal that your culture is starting to turn toxic. The second early warning sign that I want to share with you today is that there are hostile relations among staff, students, and parents, and there's a palpable lack of safety. This can manifest itself in a couple of different ways. The first way is that you might have that passive-aggressive hostility happening amongst different factions in your staff. So one team wants to do this. Another team wants to do this. First grade doesn't like third grade. Second grade blames first grade for sending them kids who can't read, and now they have to do the extra work. And so people start blaming each other. There's this underlying hostility. People are not working together. They don't feel like they're all on the same team. The second way that this can manifest is there's a hostile attitude towards students. So this is when people start to blame kids. Kids aren't doing their homework. Kids are, they didn't take their medication this morning. And they use that as an excuse for why kids are not performing. And so people are not helping kids, they're blaming kids. The third way that this manifests is in the way that people treat parents. Now, you cannot control parents who may show up at the school who are angry and hostile. But what happens when you, how you handle those parents makes all the difference. But if a parent shows up at the school and the staff treats the parent as if the parent is to blame, you're not reading to your kids at night, you're not helping kids with math, you don't get your kids to school on time, and the parents are treated like it's their fault, that they're not considered partners with the staff at your school, that's a sign that your culture is turning toxic. So whenever people don't feel safe, they begin to hide, they begin to go into small groups, they get very cliquish, they stop saying what they really feel, they're more worried about covering themselves than they are about service. That's a sign that you are heading towards toxic school culture. Number three, and this one's kind of related, there's more self-preservation than collaboration. So people stop sharing their plans with each other. People start treating each other with distrust. People start doing things to protect themselves rather than doing things or going out on a limb on behalf of students or on behalf of each other. So instead of your teams working together, they show up at a team meeting, but they don't actually work together. They're protective. They're very self-protective of their stuff. Nobody wants to work more than anybody else. People complain. This person doesn't contribute. People stop contributing. When you go to staff meeting and you ask a question, nobody raises their hand. When you have a field trip, nobody volunteers to take it on. And everybody's more concerned about protecting themselves than they are about collaborating on behalf of students. That's a sign that your culture is turning toxic. Okay, the number four, there's an absence of honest dialogue and difficult conversations are avoided. Now, I've seen this a lot in schools, and a lot of times this one's hard to pick up on your own. Sometimes it takes somebody coming from the outside in to kind of notice this, because when there's an absence of honest dialogue, it doesn't mean that there's an absence of all dialogue. People still have conversations, but don't be fooled by those conversations, because those conversations are they're artificial, they're superficial. So I see this a lot when I'm coaching principals around feedback. Principals are often afraid to give teachers honest feedback for fear that the teacher will get angry, or for fear that they'll hurt the teacher's feelings, or for fear that the teacher will retaliate, or for fear that the teacher will fight back in some way, or that the teacher will just stonewall and just shut down. And so we get very careful about giving teachers feedback that isn't honest. I call it the feedback dance. You know, it's almost like everybody has a script. You go into the conversation and you give teachers very superficial feedback, kind of based on your instrument, without getting to the truth of what's happening in the teacher's classroom. And the teacher says, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Thank you for that suggestion. And then the teacher gets brownie points for looking reflective. And you walk out of that conversation and nothing changes in the classroom. And so if there's a lack of honest dialogue, if you are not willing to have difficult conversations with other people, you are contributing to toxicity happening in your culture. Here's why. If people don't believe you're being honest with them, they won't trust you. Now, here's the other side of it. A lot of times you are giving teachers honest feedback. You are trying to engage teachers in honest dialogue. They're not being honest with you. Sometimes what happens is a teacher will say something to you and, you know, agree to do something, but then once they get out of that conversation, they'll do something exactly opposite. So if people's actions don't match their words, you have a lack of honest dialogue. If people say one thing when they're in the formal group, but say something else later on, you have a lack of honest dialogue. And so you're not having those difficult conversations. Two-way, people are afraid to talk to you. They're afraid to raise questions with you. Anytime that happens, you are facing toxicity in your culture. Number five, the back channel is more active and effective than the formal lines of communications, and a small minority dominate the discourse and other voices go unheard. We've all been in that staff meeting, right, where you raise an issue for the entire staff and two people get up and they speak passionately for one thing and nobody else has anything to say. It's not that they don't have anything to say, but they're unwilling to get up behind that person and say it. They're unwilling to say it in an open channel. Sometimes people come to you later on and say, I didn't really agree with her, but I didn't want to say anything. And they say something to you later on. Or people will say one thing and then in the meeting, or be quiet in the meeting, and then they'll have the meeting after the meeting in the parking lot or at happy hour or the next day in the staff lounge, where they really express how they feel, but they won't say it in the formal lines of communication. Have you ever had a teacher who comes to you and says, I didn't say anything in the meeting, but, and then they say something to you on the back end? Or rumors dominate. So people are hearing rumors about what you're doing and they're coming to you and saying, well, I heard you were going to do this. You say, where did you hear that? Where did you get that? But that rumor feels like gospel truth to that person. Anytime the formal lines of communications are ignored and the back channel is more reliable and more active and more effective than the formal lines of communication, it's a sign that your school culture is turning toxic. And then number six, punishment is emphasized over recognition and reward. So that means everybody's trying to avoid punishment, and because you're trying to avoid punishment, they don't want to take risks. I see this a lot in districts where teachers are getting paid to improve test scores, or teachers are getting fired if their test scores don't improve. Or, so that's kind of an extreme example. Sometimes I see examples where it's not that extreme, where it's not about whether or not I'm going to get paid if I improve test scores or get fired if I don't. Sometimes people are worried that if I say anything, if I bring a new idea to the team is going to shut me down. Or that if I disagree with a team, people are going to think that I'm a brown noser. I've also seen this with new teachers a lot. If you have a school that has gotten used to the status quo, they're used to doing things one way, and you bring a new teacher into that mix who says, or you yourself as an administrator come new into a school culture where they are satisfied with the status quo and you start making suggestions about changes, a lot of times what will happen is they will shut you down, and they may not say, be quiet, you can't speak here. They may not do it that way. They may shut you down by saying, oh, bless your heart. You are so, I love your passion, but we've tried that here before and it just won't work. Or, oh, that's queen. I'm sure you were so excited about that webinar you just did today. But, that would work over there. It's not going to work over here. So people shut you down. And so then you become afraid to speak up. I see this with new teachers a lot, where new teachers come in with new ideas. And not only do they get shut down, but they get shunned. Now all of a sudden, people don't want them on their teams, or people are ignoring them on their teams. And so a lot of times new teachers won't speak up because they don't want to become isolated from the team. And so again, this is another example of culture eating strategy for breakfast. You hired that new teacher to bring those new ideas to the team, and the team shuts those ideas down. So this is a sign of toxicity in your culture. Now what I'd like for you all to do is find your chat box. These are the six signs that I just discussed. And in the chat box, I'd love for you to type in which one. You can just type in the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Which one of these signs are you noticing in your own school culture? I'll pause for a few minutes and just go ahead and type in the chat box just a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If you have more than one, type in more than one. Okay, so I'm seeing 3 and 5, self-preservation and the back channel and minority dominating discourse. That's awesome. Oh, another one for back channel. I see a lot of the back channel coming in and the punishment that goes with it. That's awesome. I'll give you guys a few more minutes to type a few more. Number 5 is really dominating. And number 3 and number 2, I see some of those there. Okay, so 3 and 5 seems to be the big ones based on your responses. And thank you all so much for typing these in. Here's the thing about 3 and 5. The self-preservation and then the back channel where the minority dominates the discourse. I have a saying that I share with all of the principals that I coach and in the workshops that I teach, and that's this. Whoever controls the narrative controls your culture. I'll say that again. Whoever controls the narrative controls your culture. So it's no wonder that number 5 can feel like the big one that's kind of bubbling up, because if you have a back channel, that back channel is controlling the narrative about your school. And that back channel is also controlling the culture, which is why that small minority of people who dominate, they get to speak, they get heard, because they are controlling your narrative. So whoever controls the narrative controls the culture. So we want to talk about that. And what do we do? How do we deal with all of these? Because some of you are saying, I've seen all of these in different schools. Carl says that. And I've seen some people have said number 2 or number 3. Number 5 seems to be really dominating. How do you take back control over the narrative of your school? How, not so that you can control the culture, but so that you can make sure that you're having a healthy culture. How do you shut down that back channel so that it's no longer dominating discourse? How do you make sure that everybody's voice gets heard rather than just a few people who are dominating your discourse? That's what I want to talk about next. But I want to pause here in case there are any questions.
Yes, I have a question, Dr.
Go ahead. Jackson.
Most new principals, they inherit a culture that has been, that has all of these facets in it for years, and they take on this responsibility, and they have staff that's just there for the money, or there just because they've been there several years, or the community, they're just down, the whole culture is down. Can you give any advice for a new principal coming into a situation where they know the test scores are low, they know the culture is somewhat, not stable, and they're going in to do some restructuring? Can you give them a couple of examples that they could use? Because most principals are coming to that situation now, coming in the new school year.
So I'm so glad you asked the question, because what I'm about to share with you next will answer that question in spades. So you just watch. We're going to talk about, and this works whether you are a new principal or whether you've been a principal in the school for several years. One of the principals in one of my coaching groups is a brand new principal who came at the middle of the year. So she came in November, and She was an assistant principal in another building, got moved as a principal into a school in the middle of the school year. The principal at that school retired. The culture was just full of toxicity. And she had to figure out a way to kind of, you know, fix it. And she used this exact same strategy to be able to really heal her culture. And the strategy I'm going to share with you will work whether you are a new principal, whether you are an existing principal who has a pretty healthy culture, but you're starting to see these early warning signs. So either way, so let me share with you the strategy. First of all, I want to tell you what culture is. This is my definition of culture. Culture is a collection of habitual behaviors and the stories we tell ourselves about them. So think about any culture that you have. What are the habits? And then what are the stories? And that will tell you the culture. So if you're a new principal walking into a school and you want to do a quick assessment of what the culture is in your school, look at the habits. I'm not talking about, you know, the habits that are kind of state mandated. I'm talking about the habits inside the culture, habits around what time people go to work, habits around how people meet. You know, there's some schools where every meeting involves food. There are other schools where they meet in the morning, they follow a tight agenda, and they're done before things start. Some schools are very early where people come in way before school and get things done. Some schools have habits of being late schools where people get in there right before the kids do, but then they stay 2 or 3 hours after school. Some schools have a habit of a Friday happy hour. Other schools don't. Look at the habits. Look at habits around what happens when the kids are not there. So those pre-service days, what are the habits? Do people dress down? Is it more casual? Do people kind of do their own thing? Do people kind of coordinate and hang out together? What are our habits around grading? What are our habits around how we talk to students? What are our habits around how we deal with parents? All of those habits begin to tell you what the culture is. And then the second thing is listen to the stories that people tell about the culture. What are the stories that the parents are telling? I was in a school once and the kids were running around and acting really crazy. And I said, what is going on? What are you all doing? Stop that. And they said, oh, Dr. Jackson, you know, the school is ghetto. What are you talking about? So that story about the school being a quote unquote ghetto school then created, and it was an outgrowth of the habits that they had, but it justified the habits that the kids had around how they behaved in the hallways. I was in another school and they said, one of the stories that they told me about the school when they got there was that we are a school that goes the extra mile for kids. And they had tons of stories about people going the extra mile for kids. So that told me that value was really important to them. And then when I went in the classroom, I saw that they had built into the school day time for reteaching and reassessing, that they had after school programs, that if kids were not ready to take the test when the test was given, they would extend the time into the summertime so the students were able to catch up and then take the test when they were ready to take the test. So that the habits and the stories create the culture. Now let me tell you why this is important. There's a lot of research around habit change, and they're saying if you want to change habits, because when you're changing a culture, all you're doing is changing the habits and changing the stories. But if you want to change habits, you have to change three things. You have to change the identity, the concept of yourself. You have to change the process, and then you have to change the outcome. Habit change happens a lot of times, well, people try to change habits a lot of times by only changing the process. But if they don't change their identity, they won't get a different outcome. So let me give you an example. I have two people who are standing outside, and I go to the first person and I offer them a cigarette. We're on a break at a conference, and I offer them a cigarette. I go to the first person and say, hey, would you like a cigarette? And the first person says, no, thanks, I'm trying to stop smoking. And then I go to the second person and say, hey, would you like a cigarette? And that person says, no, thanks, I don't smoke. So think about that. Which person is more likely to slip up and come back to me later on and say, hey, can I get that cigarette you offered me earlier? Is it the person who said, I am trying to stop smoking, or the person who said, I don't smoke? Well, go ahead, type it in. Who do you think it's going to be? Type it in the panel. What are your guesses? Is it the person who says, I am trying to stop smoking, or the person who says, I don't smoke? Okay. All right. So we're kind of split. So Annette says, I don't smoke. A couple of you say trying. Some people say I'm trying to stop smoking. Let me tell you what the research says. The person who says, I am trying to stop smoking has not changed their identity. Their identity is, I am a smoker who is trying to stop. The person who says, I don't smoke is going to be the person who says, they have changed their identity. They no longer see themselves as a smoker. So that person is more likely to stick to the not smoking than the person who says, I am trying not to smoke. Now let me take that to schools. The schools who have the most success in healing their culture don't try to change the behaviors, right? So we have staff that's not working together. So what do? We go, we put them into PLCs and we lock them in a room together and we say collaborate. And it doesn't work because we haven't changed our identity as we are a school who collaborates together on behalf of children. You've got people who are mean to each other. People are overwhelmed. They're just tired and exhausted. They feel overworked. So what do? We put cookies in the staff lounge on Friday or donuts in the staff lounge on Friday. And those donuts say, they're nice. People will eat your donuts, but they haven't changed the feeling of being overwhelmed. So if you're going to change habits, you have to change how I see myself, my identity. You have to change the processes, my integrity, and then you change the outcomes, my impact. That's how you change a habit. Now, that sounds very theoretical, but let's talk about what that means. When you are going to change your culture, you have to change your habits and you have to change your story. So every culture has three questions, and those three questions are this. What are we building? Why is that important? And what's my role? Whenever people come into your school, they have those questions. And if you don't answer those questions for them, they will answer those questions for themselves. And the way that they answer those questions for themselves controls your narrative. And whoever controls your narrative controls your culture. So how do you change your habits? How do you change your story? Here's what you do. You have to work on your vision, your mission, and your core values. Now, before you roll your eyes, because I know you've heard this before, we're going to do it radically differently than any way you've ever been trained to do it. Your vision is, what are we building? That's your impact. Your mission is why it's important. That's your integrity. And your core values are, what's my role? That's your identity. Now I'm going to go back. Remember those three questions we asked? If you want to change the culture, these three questions have to get answered. And if you do that, if you answer these three questions, look at that. You will now change the habits because you will deal with the identity, the integrity, and the impact. And when you do that, you will change the culture. Now, that's a theory. Let's look at what that looks like. The first thing is, you need a different vision. The vision answers the question, what are we building? I spent a lot of time looking at school vision statements, and most of them are useless. And let me tell you why. School vision statements say things like, we are building 21st century learners who will reach their full potential and in a diverse and nurturing environment. And again, I don't know what we're building, because all of those are buzzwords, but they don't tell me what we at this school are building. So you have to answer the question, what are we building, so that you can help people understand the work we do here is going to have this kind of impact. I've also seen a different kind of vision statement, one that says, by the 2020, we will increase reading scores by 12.75% and math scores by 17.2%. Anybody ever look at that and say, wow, 12.5%, we're making such a huge impact. I am inspired. I want to stay late. I want to really work towards that goal. No, because those visions may satisfy a data point, but that vision statement is not going to move people forward. It's not going to explain to people, this is what we're building. Nobody is going to get excited about building a 12.5% gain in test scores. What does that even mean? How many kids is that? What is that going to do? So my rule for your vision is that your vision must include 100% of your students. If you are setting a vision that only includes 12.5% of your students, you are not building anything. You are satisfying requirements. And people want to know, what are we building? So your vision has to include 100% of your students. And it has to have a clear, measurable outcome for all students. So let me give you a couple of examples of some of the vision statements that we've created that have helped start to galvanize and change and heal culture. what first mission statement is, so my role is 100% of your kids, and your vision is really the promise that you're making to 100% of your kids. So one elementary school principal I worked with said, because she looked at her community and she realized that if kids did not get proficient at reading by second grade, then you could directly correlate the number of kids who were not proficient in reading by second grade to the number of prisons they would need in that community in 10 years. And so she said, that's got to be our focus, second grade reading. So her vision is 100% of our second graders will be reading at or above proficiency by the end of second grade. Now, is that clear? Yes. Is it measurable? Yes. Does it include all of her students? Yes. But here's what it does for her school. When people go in to that school and they're trying to figure out what work do we do, what's important, should we do this or should we do that? Her vision is this, whatever you do has to be focused on getting 100% of our kids at or above proficiency by second grade and maintaining proficiency throughout the rest of their career here in the school. All of a sudden, everybody's clear. And you know that back channel we talked about earlier, that narrative we talked about earlier, a lot of that goes away because everybody's clear about what we're building. If you stop any teacher in the building in the hallway and you say, hey, what's your vision? What are you all building here in the school? They said, well, we're trying to get kids to read at or above proficiency by second grade and maintain that reading level throughout. Everybody has the answer, and they can tell you why. And once people get focused on a vision, they don't have time or energy or space to focus on all the nonsense that they were focused on before. That vision starts every staff meeting for her. That vision determines who gets assigned where and why. That vision drives the work of that school. Here's another example of a vision. In another school where I'm working, the principal said, I asked her, what's the point of your school? What are you building here? And she said, we're really building well-rounded students. And I said, what does that look like? And she said, well, it looks like literacy in reading, in math, in social studies, in science, and in social skills. So her vision is now 100% of our students will be literate in these five core areas by the time they leave our school in fifth grade. And that means that, so what is that going to look like? Is your school geared towards that right now? She said, no. So she's changed her school. They have created a portfolio assessment that kids start building their portfolios in kindergarten, and they trace their growth as a learner, and they trace their growth as a literate human being throughout their entire career at her elementary school. And by the time kids get to fifth grade, they have a portfolio day where they invite people in the community, including the students' parents, and they present their portfolios and they talk about their growth and their journey as learners and to their journey to becoming literate human beings. Now, with that kind of vision, when everybody knows that's what we're getting to, we're guaranteeing that by the time they leave here in fifth grade, everybody will be able to do that. It changes the focus of the work. People don't waste time on work that isn't focused around that. Okay, so that's the vision. Now, here are the rules around your mission. Your mission, remember, answers the question, why is it important? And I hear a lot of mission statements. We exist to help students become global citizens in a global society for lifelong learning. And, it's just blah, blah, blah. Again, our mission statements don't help us with our culture. Your mission statement is about integrity. If you have a clear mission, then you can tell right away, is that behavior on mission or off mission? And if it's off mission, you can call each other on that in your culture because you're saying, hey, listen, we're really focused on this over here. That stuff you're doing over here, that stuff is not on mission. So I can't give time and energy and attention to that because we're focused on moving here. Again, that helps you and everybody in your culture get focused on the right work. So your mission statement has to be clear. People have to know exactly what you do. It has to be concise, and it should be compelling. So here are some examples of mission statements. We exist to be a safe place in the community where students can explore their full potential without being socially, emotionally, or physically harmed. That's a school that works in a really high impact area where they see themselves as we are a safe place in this community. So the work that they do, the way they structure their their school is around safety. So when people are doing things that hurt kids academically, emotionally, you know, I can go into a teacher's classroom and I can, and the kids are not learning, and I can say, you are not a safe place for learning, because you, kids have come to your classroom, they're trusting you to lead them in learning, and you are not doing that. So you're not being safe. I can hold people accountable. I can make sure that they're staying on mission. When people come to me and they say, we want to do this program, we want to do this program, I can go back and say, is that program going to provide that safety and support? Here's another mission statement example. We exist to help students learn to love rigorous learning. I just worked with the school on that mission statement. So all of a sudden, they have to now look at, is the work we're doing helping students love learning and love rigorous learning? And what they're finding is that some of the work that they're doing, it's off mission. It's fun. Kids love it. But it's not helping kids learn in a rigorous way. So they're rethinking the programs and the work they're doing because it's off mission. Okay? So you have to give a vision. Your vision is your 100% promise to all kids. This is what we guarantee. You come to our school. This is what you can. We guarantee everyone will get as a result. The mission says, this is why we're here. This is why we exist. This, and Simon Sinek talks about that all the time. You have to give people a why. Your mission is the why. The last thing you need is you need core values. And the core values answer the question, what is my role? And if you're going to start somewhere, I would start with the core values, because the core values get to the heart of the habit change, which is really about identity. So what's my role? And you're not answering that, I'm a fourth grade teacher, you're the media specialist. No, that is your job. Your role has to be bigger than that. So your role, and I see your question about the difference between vision and mission. So I'll go back and I'll explain the difference between all three again so that you can see that. But your role is around your identity, your core values around your identity. So my rules around core values are this. A lot of schools have core values. They have core values like loyalty and diversity and learning as a core value, but I don't even know what those mean, and nobody else knows what those mean either. So when you have core values that are really generic and they're negotiable, it means people can make up their own idea about those core values. People can all decide what loyalty means to them, and they can use that to excuse any kind of behavior you want. When your core values are non-negotiables, you're saying, as an organization, we will all commit to these core values. We will all commit to behaving in accordance with these core values. And once you do that and they become non-negotiable, again, people become more accountable. People have very clear guidance about what's expected of them. And that can begin to start redefining your culture. The next thing is that your core values have to be supported by all. So let's go back to the issue earlier. Let's go back to the issue earlier around a new principal. A lot of times when you come in as a new principal, you will inherit core values. Maybe they just did a core values exercise last year. And you go around to everybody and you say, what are our school core values? And everybody kind of shrugs, or maybe they give you one or two. You know those core values are negotiable, because if they were non-negotiable, everybody would know it. You also know those core values haven't been supported by all, because if they were supported by all, everybody would know them. So what you have to do is you have to reconvene your staff. And this is one of the most powerful things you can do. You bring your staff together and you either re-examine the core values that exist or you start building new ones. And here's the way that I like to do it. You come in, you're a new principal. You say, these are the core values that are here that I could find. Do we still agree with these? And you have conversations around them. Well, I agree with it. What does, and then you start asking questions. Okay, well, I'm new here. What does loyalty mean? And then people are going to start giving you answers, and they're going to start disagreeing. And then you're going to say, so here's what I want to do. Clearly, we need to kind of come together around these a little bit more, because the core values guide our behavior. They guide what we're supposed to do. So let's kind of re-examine these core values. And then you end the meeting. A couple of weeks later, you go to the small teams, either PLCs or grade level teams, and you ask them three questions. The first question you're going to ask them is, imagine that the students that you are retiring, and at your retirement ceremony, the students you have right now come and they speak at your retirement ceremony. What is it that you want them to say about their time in your classroom? people are going to say things like, I want them to say that they learned to love learning in my classroom. I want them to say that I treated them fairly. I want them to say that I really gave them space to be their own person. Whatever that is, you write that on a piece of chart paper. Next question. Imagine that the students you have right now are celebrating their 25-year reunion and they come back. What is it that you want to say, you want them to say about their time here at the school? And they're going to say things like, I want them to say that they made lifelong friends. I want them to say that they really grew as individuals. I want them to say that they felt safe here. You write all those things on the board. Those are their real core values. Not loyalty, not respect. Respect always shows up, and usually respect means I want the kids to stop mouthing off at me and do their homework. That's not what you mean by respect. What you want to do is you want to get, if you ask people their core values, they're going to tell you things that are missing or that they think that they need. When you ask people those two questions that I told you, you're going to get to the core of their real values, what's really important to them. Then once you've visited the small teams and you've done that, now you take everything out in a staff meeting and you put all those posters on the wall. You give everybody three stickers. They go around and they identify the three that resonate the most with them. What you're going to find is once you're done, you're going to look around. There are going to be some with no stickers. There are going to be some with a bunch of stickers. The ones with no stickers, you're going to cross out because those are not non-negotiable. Those are not supported by all. The ones with a lot of stickers, you're going to look and see, are some of them are going to be really similar, so you're going to start combining them. Others you're going to have conversations about, and you have the conversation with your staff. What do we mean by this? What does this mean? Why do we want this? Why is this important? And everybody starts getting in the conversation. And when you walk out of that conversation, you're going to say, let's come up with three that are non-negotiable for our school. And then everybody has veto. So one person can say, nope, I can't support that. And if they do, that's okay. Keep having the conversation until everybody can support it. If you do that, if you engage people in coming together around real core values, first of all, the conversation, the debate, the back and forth, it's going to be valuable because people are going to really start to get passionate about it. They're going to say their truth. They're going to speak truthfully in official form. So you start to overcome those signs of toxicity. You've got transparency. You're part of that conversation. You talk about your core values. And so now everybody understands each other better. But here's this next thing. If you get those three core values identified and then you start to run your school based on those three core values as non-negotiable, you will change your culture. Here's what I mean by that. When we did this at my school for the first time, we couldn't narrow it down to three. We got four core values. We made posters. Everybody thought, okay, good, that's done. Took us 2 months. Good, that's done. Now we can get back to our work. No. When I did the master schedule, our master schedule reflected our core values. So we changed our master schedule. One of our core values is lifelong learning. And what that meant was we felt like students should learn for the sake of learning, not learn to get a grade. That meant that we had to make sure that we included reteaching and reassessing in our schedule. So what we did is we built time in every single day for students to do reteaching, reassessing, or enrichment because our core value was lifelong learning. And if it's going to be a core value, then it should be a part of our schedule. So people started coming to me and saying, well, I want to teach this and I want to teach that. And I would say, well, how does that align with our core values? And all of a sudden people are like, don't come back to me until you can tell me. If you can make a case for that aligning with our core values, I can support it. People are coming to me, we want to take this field trip. How does that align with our core values? If they didn't have an answer, I can't support it. People were coming to me. We did our hiring. So when we interviewed people, remember I said people hire for skill and fire for will? We changed our interview questions, and all of our interview questions were designed to determine whether or not this person shared our core values. Everything we did, from who we interviewed to how we assigned teachers to the master schedule to how we disciplined kids to how we dealt with parents, all of that then became sifted through our core values. And here's what happens. When you make your core values that alive in your building, you can trust people to make decisions without coming to you. Because they're going to make as long as they make decisions that align with our core values, as long as they make decisions that are on mission, as long as they make decisions that support our vision, I can support their decisions. And once people saw that, they trusted me more. They began to, the culture began to develop this transparency. the culture began to heal, the toxicity, the hostility began to change, people started speaking up, and people started calling each other out for behavior that wasn't in alignment with our core values. That's how you begin to heal a toxic culture. So let me go back and talk about these again. So I'm just going to go back to, because someone wanted to know the difference between vision, mission, and core values. Here's the difference. Vision is about what we are building. Mission is about why that's important. So let me give you an example. Vision, all kids will be on grade level by second grade in reading and will maintain or increase their proficiency throughout the rest of their time here in the school. That's our vision. That's our promise, right? Our mission. Why is that important? Because we want to make sure that we're giving kids every single opportunity to break the cycle of this community and to be able to have a better future. And then my role is those are the core values. I'm going to do that by making sure that I support every single student and nurture in them a love of learning. I'm going to do that by making sure that I treat every student with respect and dignity. So you see how that is? When you think about mission, vision, and core values the way we've traditionally done it, there isn't a lot of difference between vision and mission. But when you think about it as vision answers the question, what are we building? What's our impact going to be? Mission answers the question, why are we building this? That's really about our integrity. What's the thing that's driving us? Why is this important? And then our core values, what's my role? How am I going to do it? Who are we going to be? And who are we going to be no matter what? If you answer those three things for people, you've taken over control of the narrative again, and you've focused people on doing the right work the right way. All right, so I want to give us a little bit of time for questions. And I see that Christy has a question here about how do you start the conversation about vision. So I talked to you about the core values process because I think core values have to be developed by all, but vision is something that you develop and is expected of you as a leader. So as the building, I don't say leader, I say builder, because I think that leaders lead and there's one leader and a lot of followers. Builders build. They go out and they start building and then they invite people. So I have a saying, it's not mine, I stole it, but it's bosses say go, leaders say let's go, builders say come. So as a builder, you are inviting people to a bigger vision. So you come to people with a vision. You don't have a discussion where you create a vision together as a school. You come in and you say, based on our core values, based on why we are here, what we've talked about, that conversation about why we are here, this is what we're going to build. And you build that. You bring that to people. And so you come in and you say, this is what we're going to build, and you invite other people to that. And you base it on the vision, I mean, on the mission and the core values. I hope I answered that, Christy. If not, go ahead and type in a follow-up question. Okay, Carl is asking, core values are often called belief statements. Yeah, they are, but I think a lot of times with belief statements, you get into belief statements really are things like, okay, we believe that all children deserve a good quality education. We believe, and you make these belief statements. The difference between core values and belief statements are that a belief statement is just my philosophical idea. The core values are who I am. So you can believe that all children have a right to learn without it being non-negotiable in your building. But if you really believe that all children deserve to be in a classroom every day learning, and that becomes non-negotiable, you will stop out-of-school suspensions. Because that, so a belief statement is I believe all students can learn. Nobody's going to hold me accountable if I act against that belief. A core value, when it's a non-negotiable, you can call me in the carpet, right? So that's the difference. Core values, the way that I teach them, they have to be non-negotiable or they don't really serve anybody. And I see a lot of we believe statements where I always go to school when I'm consulting in a school. First thing I do is I say, tell me your vision, mission, and core values. They do. Then I say, show me your master schedule. Because I can tell your real core values and your real beliefs by looking at your master schedule. Because that will tell me whether the adults get priority or the kids get priority. That will tell me what's really important to your school. The next thing I do is I say, show me your, now that I've seen your master schedule, let me go into classrooms. Show me how you give teachers feedback. Show me how you give teachers support. Show me how you hold teachers accountable. Let me take a look and peruse your culture. If those things are not alive in your culture, then they don't mean anything. They only mean something if you are governing yourselves based on these three things. What are we building? Why is it important? And what's my role? Okay, so Christy's asking, if we come with the vision, does that take away from the culture of having a shared vision, right? Shared vision is a huge buzzword, and here's the what I have to say about shared vision. It's an old joke. What's a camel? It's a horse built by committee. The whole idea about being a builder is that you come to people with a vision, and then what gets it to be a shared vision is you help everybody else buy into that vision because that vision aligns with your mission and your core values. That's what makes it a shared vision. It's really hard to develop a shared vision staff-wide. You can do it with core values, but they're looking to you for the vision about where we're going. That's your role. And so I know that shared vision is a buzzword. I just have never seen it work. I've not been in one school where there's a shared vision that they created together that is going to be motivating and exciting and gets everybody moving forward. I've seen a lot of language around shared vision. I've never seen a school with a shared vision alive and well in the school. What I have seen, and even when the schools where it looks like it's working, who's driving it? The building principal. So come with that vision, invite people to be a part of that vision, and then get everybody galvanized and working towards that vision. That's what makes it a shared vision. All right, so the book that someone's asking, Gladys is asking, what's the name of the book? It contains the webinar content, right? So Gladys, I'm writing that book. That's my next book. So the book that I mentioned earlier, which is Never Underestimate Your Teachers, is really about will and skill. And so it's about how do you develop that in teachers. The book that I'm writing now is called, the working title is The Four Disciplines of Buildership, and it's going to talk about feedback, support, accountability, and this one is going to be in the culture section. So it's not there yet. But I do teach this content. We have a three-day intensive that we do several times a year called Builders Lab, and I teach the content in Builders Lab. And I'll show you if you want to find out or learn more information. I also teach it on my podcast. I have a podcast called School Leadership Reimagined. So if you're a podcast person, I'm teaching this every week, and you can just text the word builder to the number 33444. And you will get, you'll get a text back that asks for your email, and that'll get you signed up so that you can get this kind of training every single week through the podcast. My podcast is where I do trainings like this every single week. They're about a half hour long, and they take some aspect of this and go into detail about how to do this in your school. All right, so I think we are close to, we have a few more minutes for questions. And and then I'm going to turn this back over to you, Aaron, at the end. So if there aren't any more questions, we're going to turn, I'll turn this back over to you, Aaron.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Jackson, for all that information that you shared. I learned a lot today, so I know our listeners did. Again, your information, your email, can we go to that?
Sure. So at the bottom of the slide, you'll see mindstepsinc.com. And, well, that says mindstepsinc. It should say mindstepsinc.com. And that's my website, and that's how you can reach out to me, or you can send me an email directly. The best way to reach me is info@mindstepsinc.com.
Yes, and I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Honor has just typed it in the chat box for anybody that wanted to know that information. We also want to remind everybody about our Super Bowl of events. We have our 2019 Pre-K to 8 Principals Conference coming up in Spokane, Washington, July the 10th through the 12th. So make sure you register for that on our website. I want to thank Dr. Jackson for being with us today and sharing on this webinar Wednesday. I want to thank my partner behind the scenes, Honor Feedy, as well as our executive director, Dr. Earl Franks, and our associate executive director, Gail Morgan of Professional Learning. My name is Aaron Lurie. I'm the director of Professional Learning here at NAESP. Thanks again, Dr. Jackson, and catch us again in our next series of Webinar Wednesdays. Everyone have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.